The Rebel Leadership Podcast, a refreshing take on authentic leadership told through real stories. Let's smash the status quo and change how leaders lead once and for all. In late 2016, a six-year-old boy named Alex Midaberry wrote a letter to President Obama offering to help a five-year-old Syrian refugee boy. If you recall, the iconic image of the horrific conflict in Syria showed a young boy covered in blood and dust in an ambulance after his house in Aleppo was destroyed in a blast. Obama not only read Alex's letter, but he celebrated his kindness at the White House and as a part of Obama's international refugee speech at the time. His mom, Val Midaberry, held back tears and disbelief as she got the call from the White House that day. She may not have realized the tremendous impact her positive influence at home had on her son then, but she's reflecting on it today, right here on this episode of the Rebel Leadership Podcast. Val is the Associate Dean of Graduate, International, and Online Programs at Cordoza Law in New York City. She is as kind as she is smart, determined as she is radiant, positive as she is impactful. Her story of immigrating to the U.S. begins washing dishes to learn English herself and can be fast-forwarded to influencing lives through education. We reflect on all things positivity and the role leaders play in shaping future generations. Listen, reflect, and embrace your next aha moment.
The topic of refugees came up because Alex always sees me read a lot of interesting things around the world. But he came to my phone when I was looking at the photo of Omran Daknish, the boy that was, you know, captured by the ambulance and saved by the ambulance during a bombing in Aleppo. And I tried to scroll away the photo so he wouldn't see it because it's too traumatizing. But I explained to him that, oh, this article is talking about the boy who is living in a war and they're looking for his brother. And we discussed it as a way. I didn't show him the picture. And that's what he was upset about, because he wanted to see the picture, but I scrolled it away. Then the next day when he was with his grandparents and they had CNN on, because my in-laws always have CNN on, he noticed that that was actually the boy that Mama mentioned the night before. And all day they were talking about Omran Daknish. My mother-in-law was cooking. And she said, I see his chin is shaking from crying.
Oh, right. Wow. An empathetic six-year-old.
But the old children are. I just feel like it's so unfair that Alex has been, glorified in this story. But I think every child who you have the time and you do discuss with them what happens in the world in your own way, I think they all would respond that way with a lot of love, a lot of compassion. We have seen it in our schools. We've seen it in activities against bullying, against guns. Children are amazing, right? And we need to continue to shape them as future voters, future leaders, future citizens to continue with those values, because they're gonna be stronger. Kindness is not weakness. You know, kindness is strength, I think. And it takes much harder work to be kind than to be mean or to be short with people. We all have moments where we don't bring our best out there, but at least your core value, being kind and being open to discussing with your children how to preserve those values.
It's amazing, because I know you said that it's not fair that he's been glorified, but isn't that the point of leaders like President Obama shining a light on positive situations, of positive leaders shining a light on positive impact? There is a point to proclaiming this stuff and to show witness to all the good that's happening, because it does trigger that snowball that we talked about before.
Absolutely. And if it were another president, I don't think this would have happened. It is truly the merit of President Obama, who was not just a person who always listened to the citizens through those 10 letters every day, which I had no idea, actually, before Alex's letter was read. I was a busy mom. I really didn't pay much attention to politics or to the life of a president, right? We were very proud when President Obama won, but the impact that he made through the voices of just normal citizens, immigrants like us, That's why when they called me and they said, we need permission, or we are asking for permission so that President Obama can read Alex's letter. And you go back in time when you're washing dishes or cleaning floors at restaurants and trying to save every dollar to go to school. And you're like, how's it possible that that's happening to me? It's because of leaders like President Obama. And we're going to feel that impact of his leadership for good for generations to come.
And there was another leader that you didn't mention there, but that was you as a mom. That it is well-rounded. It's about the people that we're exposed to on a global scale. It's about the people we're exposed to in our careers, in our educational track, in our home life. It's, I think we're all in this together from a positive leadership standpoint.
You're a mom yourself, right? How busy is the day? You don't think that by having a 5-minute conversation on some newspaper article would actually make such an impact in your child in the future. So as you said, my leadership as a mom, I never knew I had that much impact in a kid. I thought I was just raising them and going fast to work and school. But yet every little moment actually matters to them. And that's, the teachers also matter to them, what they see in the news or what they're exposed to. I really took that moment as a learning opportunity for myself. I have to be careful what I say and how I say to them, because they're just sponges and they absorb so much. So yeah, absolutely. We have the opportunity to shape so many around us. As an immigrant, when I arrived in the United States, I had no idea what to expect, right? So I was an Albanian, law student. I was always driven to do well in school. I liked getting A's. I spoke 2 or 3 languages at the time I graduated law school, but I didn't speak English because our system was Franco-Italian in Albania. So I always thought I was going to get my master's in France or Switzerland. So I came to the United States with a green card lottery. I played during a time where Albania was having, trouble economically and politically. It was 1997. So I was very lucky that with this lottery that I played as a joke, God or nature brought me to the United States, and I was able to kind of change my future. So right from the start, I began enrolling. Actually, the first week I was in US, I enrolled in classes in college as English as a second language. I was able to get jobs because I had the green card, and work in restaurants, work as babysitter, any jobs I could find. As long as it was legal, I did it. And it was very... it was an awakening for me, because I had never done service jobs before. In Albania, I was lucky to be a very good student. I had good educated family. So I had never worked in my life other than school. So beginning
what were some of those jobs that you had?
Waiting tables at a diner, a Greek diner in Ridgewood, New Jersey. That's actually when I met my husband, also from Albania, and he was a waiter in Philadelphia. And then sometimes if we found jobs to cleaning homes, we would do it together or with other friends, making extra money. If my cousin was painting apartments or houses, we would go and clean with him. Dishwashing, like anything we could find, we did it. Babysitting, everybody in the town knew my name, so I could babysit, and I loved spending time with kids. So I never slept before 2 a.m. I would be studying every evening for my English classes. And then later I started taking political science classes or economics classes just to learn the language of, other than the working language. So I would enroll for non-credits or non-degree seeking, because I didn't need a degree, at Ramapo College or at Rutgers University. And every semester I was always enrolled to try to learn something new, so that once I felt ready, I could go work for law firms or I could go back to law school. And that took a lot of commitment for 4 years. That's all we did with my husband. Lots of studies, lots of work. And then the light started showing. He got a very good job. Then he went to his master's degree, and his job paid for his master's degree. And I could go back to law school. And I studied at Cardozo, pursued my kind of ambitions there. And what I would say about that new journey as an immigrant is that you have to keep an open mind in each step, like even when I was at diners, waiting tables, or in a babysitting job, whatever challenge I faced, I always saw the silver lining. I always saw the lessons from it. And I think I'm a better dean today because I had the experiences as a waitress, as a babysitter, as a dog walker, whatever we did. I feel like those humble experiences made me better as a person, made me put myself into people's shoes if they're struggling, students who might be doing those jobs as they try to get through law school. So keeping an open mind and kind of approaching every educational experience with, oh, I'm doing this thing extra so that, I never thought I would be in academia. I never thought I would be a dean. But you don't plan it just that far ahead. You just want to do the best you can each semester, the best you can each year, and then things open up for you.
Were there influencers in your life that made you see it glass half full like you're describing?
It's a great question. My mom was a very hardworking woman. So of course she was an inspiration on the hardworking part, but she tended to be a little bit too pessimistic. She grew up in communism. Of course, everything was pessimistic and gray back then. So for every dream I would express her, like, I'm gonna go to America and I'm gonna, and she was like, are you kidding me? That's impossible. So in a way, the negativity or the pessimism that any of my people shared with me made me more stubborn on the positive. Like, I wanna be optimistic. I wanna see big dreams. I want to share positivity with the world. And so we were not a religious country. We were grew up in communism. And yet I embraced Christianity and the lessons that I learned, let's say through the Bible or through any classes that we could do as a positivity, not as a religion, but as like, wow, this is such a good message of hope. And so I was seeking people who spread hope, leaders who had, you know, expressions of hope, because you're just growing up with so much gray. And those were the first influencers that I want the best. I want to be optimistic and I want to share positivity. And then as you come to America, there are so many people. Sometimes it's your boss. Sometimes could be my husband is always such a great inspiration to me. My in-laws, like I've been lucky to be surrounded by people who tend to support. We support each other and we are lifting each other up.
And don't you think that when you embrace that optimism yourself and you are that positive person, that it also attracts other positive people and almost snowballs on itself?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the most important message about positivity and optimism, that not only it becomes a solution because you work hard with the stubbornness towards that end, towards that great result that you want, but also you are attracting and building more positivity in others. So if I have team members that are having a bad day, and they, you know, we all have bad days, we all have difficulties, and you walk in with a message of positivity or, you know, seeing things differently, that person is uplifted, that person is going to do better, and they're going to continue to kind of feel that it's better to be positive than to be negative. I'm a big believer in that snowball effect. You said it perfectly. The world of always seeking the bottom line and all the capitalism that we live in, which has great advantages, right? A lot of competition and a lot of great big dreams and success stories that we have seen, great corporations that are serving on the cutting edge of the best innovation in the world. So that ambition in America or in our capitalistic world has been benefiting us. And I would say a lot of leaders are actually very positive in what they want. They're determined. It's just that how you treat others, you can't, like, it's good to have positivity. And many of our leaders do have positivity in what they want. They are clear with what they want. They want it, it's getting done, and they seek those results. But it's also the journey along that way of how you treat others. So I see positivity a bit broader than others, perhaps, in not only reaching good results and working hard and pushing people to work hard, which is perfectly fine, but also treating people the right way, so they are inspired to getting there, not hating you along the way to getting there. I find that that should be our future. And so far in the past, we have always put people down in many corporations. You've seen how women have been treated. You know, work-life balance in many corporations, it has been terrible. If there is a financial crisis, even when companies are benefiting more on the bottom line, they're using the as an excuse, they're using a crisis or some kind of market event to cut benefits, right? To do something that profits them more. Right. And I find that a bit problematic, and schools don't teach positivity, or maybe now they're starting to do more on the humanities aspect. You see lots of degrees that are out there combining humanities with leadership, and the model of fostering leaders, the old model, the GM model, the old industries, it's no longer working.
Yeah. Because, I was just going to ask you, like, where do you think it starts?
Well, definitely in the family, I think. Some people might have hardships and they just want to turn, they want to be stubborn, as I mentioned, to turn those into positivity, but it starts in the family. And I think as children, we are very positive. Ask a child if they want something and they'll find every excuse, every reason to convince you that you got to get it, right? They're excellent they have excellent persuasive skills because they have that positivity in them. They start with a lot of love. I mean, we're all born to love. You've seen it in pictures of babies and you've seen it in videos of animals with babies. I just feel like the world starts on a very good...
it's pure.
Yes, it's pure. It's innocent. And how wonderful that some of the most important traits as humans, like love, positivity, and kindness towards others, it's actually born. We have it there. And somehow along the way, either through competition or school or what we envision the strength of a leader. Maybe you are perceived to be stronger if you are mean to others, or you are perceived to be bringing more results if you are harsh and rude, which is not the case, actually. I feel that having, you know, we're born with such amazing characteristics, and losing them along the way is such a missed opportunity for humanity. And that's where we have to work on continuing. You know, even if the topics are hard, like refugees, even if, you know, homelessness, our children do see homelessness. You can't ignore it. It cannot be that it's not their problem and you don't teach them about it.
How have you done that in your life with teaching your kids about topics that are not necessarily positive topics, but doing so with kindness and education in mm-hmm. your home?
Well, it starts from them. They are the ones that ask the questions. If you walk in New York City streets and it's a cold January day and your son is saying, why is that homeless person, you know, out there and cold, and can we help them, and what can I give him or her? So they do observe. And if we allow them to observe and have a conversation about what they're observing, even if it's difficult, a topic, it becomes a lesson, right? You want them to care, and they already care about humans around them. If a friend is hurt in school, either the feelings were hurt or somebody said something, if at home you are conversing with your children and you are opening those conversations that could be a difficult topic, that child will have the courage to approach a friend in school and say, oh, can I help you? Are you okay? When Alex was 5 in kindergarten, his teacher told me we had a kid from Japan, and Alex pretended he was speaking Japanese, trying to imitate the sounds that she was making just so that she could feel comfortable. Now, if you do it as a grown-up, they'll tease you, but as a child, we, you know, many children are programmed to kind of care that way. And if you encourage that, even if it's a difficult situation, you can find a solution.
And now fast forward as Associate Dean yourself, what do you feel like is your greatest responsibility in the role you're playing at Cordoza Law?
I think the biggest focus that I have, or the biggest priority that I have, is to first allow my international students, I have students from 30 countries every year, to allow them to have an amazing experience in New York, an extraordinary education, create a community of kind people with each other. And that's a huge, right from the beginning when we do our orientation. And it really works. I found Cardozo from the beginning to be a place of kindness and support and leadership and community. We were the first school in New York to launch the Outlaw Society for the LGBTQ community. Students of many faiths have found their place there. So it's a very unique community in my experience. So my priority is to make sure that that translates in shaping these lawyers. I want them to be kind to each other, kind to the administrators and the faculty members, as we are to them. And secondly, it's really building up their confidence. They're going through a tough market, especially now with COVID. Seeing students be broken up sometimes, like if you have family members who lost loved ones to COVID, or you may have lost your family's business because of COVID. So all those stories of challenge and hardship, we want to build them to overcome those challenges and be strong again. And final is make an impact in others. Like Cardozo's motto is bringing law to life. That means whatever you learn in your classrooms, you got to help the society out there and use it for the best of the society. And we have seen it in many of our clinics. We have excellent clinics that help the poor and they help the immigrants. And when the travel ban was issued, our students were the first to join at the airport, to join other lawyers and to try to release some of the detainees. And that becomes just such a rewarding. It's no longer a job. Like, I don't feel that I'm working. I feel that I am part of this journey in shaping these students for the best of the community.
Have you found it helpful along the way to like pick up on micro moments or other people around you that you saw yourself imitating, or or people that you were like, oh, don't want to be that person? What were some stories or moments for you that kind of shaped who you are today?
Absolutely. I think we have had some great leaders at Yeshiva and at Cardozo, and we still do. And I find myself to be like a glue to those, inspiring people. I'm very easy to ask questions and learn from them. I have it very easy because maybe that's, as an immigrant, that's how I learned to communicate. If I admire someone and I say, oh, that's such an inspiration moment you're teaching us, I do it. I say it. I'm vocal with compliments and, to people that help me. At Yeshiva especially, we are lucky to have the Provost Boatman. She is extremely inspiring to me. She's always kind and poised and calm, and yet like the leadership that she does and everything she does is so impactful. You don't have to raise your voice or be mean or be someone who is scary in order to be respected and heard in meetings and other decision-making opportunities. My boss, Melanie Leslie, she's the first woman dean of Cardozo Law School, and she has been an amazing, fierce leader in good times and in bad times. Now during COVID, I always see her lift us up instead of putting us down, and I try to imitate them. I want to be like them. I want to learn from them. It's easy in life when you have role models and you can kind of mirror their behavior. And so easy to kind of ignore those who are not behaving the way they should. You just want to walk away. Yeah.
Right. And it shapes who you don't want to become. But so those two examples that you shared of your role models are also female leaders. And yes. I've personally found it challenging to find my groove as a female leader, because sometimes being kind in your head, you mistake it for being weak. Mm-hmm. And that's not actually true. You can be confident and direct and assertive while also being kind and empathetic. And I was just curious, what's your take on that exploration that you go through as a female leader?
such a great point. And actually, I've noticed that the kinder, the smarter, the more positive they are, the more direct they are, because they know they don't wishy-washy, they don't play games. They just tell you how, when things are wrong, here's how we're going to work on it, and here's the support you need in order to do X, Y, Z. But this was wrong, this was right. There is a much more open communication when a leader is kind, I think, because the person is going to take it with like a more open mind, and they're not going to feel offended. When you are mean, when you are not loved by your team, and when you are, how can I say, because we've seen this in women and men, women to women and also men to women, that sometimes they feel threatened by a powerful woman, or sometimes they feel like, oh, she's taking the spotlight. But when you don't have insecure leaders and you are surrounded by people who are kind, I find that they are actually more productive, more direct with what they want you to achieve. And that is helpful to me. And that's why I'm hoping that I'm doing that same behavior to my team or my followers, so that whenever there is an opportunity for getting things better, I am directly telling them, because I want them to know they have my support. So it doesn't have to be, if you're kind, you're going to be perceived as weak, and then they're not going to follow your instructions, or they're not going to work hard enough. I find it the opposite.
So it was interesting, because the other day I was talking with our senior leadership team about our own business success and growth. And we realized, above all the strategies, it hasn't been about one thing that drove the most growth, or one initiative, or it was the combination of all these initiatives. But what was the heartbeat of all of it was this optimism, this positivity that rang true. And you had said something to me when we were prepping for our podcast about positivity being a solution in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And that was so profound to me, because that really is the thing that I can point my finger to that says, this is the reason why we're able to put our minds towards whatever it is that we want to achieve.
Well, I'm glad you started by getting to this point by your example at your company, because every single success story, I think, in the human life has started with that positive mindset. And we don't give it enough credit. We don't say, oh, this is why. We always say that person worked hard, or they were really waking up at 5 a.m. and doing, let's say, 5 hours of tennis, if they're a big tennis champion. So we always dedicate things to hard work, and of course, hard work, team communication, sometimes luck. You know, you have to have a little bit of luck when you're building a business. But at the end of the day, it all wraps up into positivity as a solution. Because if you didn't think you're going to have this impact, right, with your podcast, or if I didn't think I was going to have some top students from the 30 countries in the world, then I wouldn't be doing all the hard work during the year. You wouldn't be talking to me. You wouldn't be believing in what you're doing, right? So seeing that end game, that solution, is only coming through positivity. And it happens every day in everything, from Elon Musk and what he's achieved to, you know, Apple and how it got to be the top technology company that it is. Every story, to three of the quotes of General Powell, may he rest in peace, right? He had three quotes. He had 13 rules of success, but three of those are on positivity. Happy to read them, right? He said, it can be done. One of his rules is like, it can be done. The other one that I love is, don't take counsel of your fears and naysayers. So don't listen to the no, to the people who say no. And finally, perpetual optimism is a force multiplier. So we need, as humans, to believe in the end results. And if anything, you don't need to invest more money. That's what's beautiful about positivity. It costs nothing. It costs nothing. You're talking about growing a business, growing a school, growing a mission. And it takes a budget, and it takes expertise, and you need to hire people and all that. Positivity could be the main reason for success. It doesn't cost anything. And yet we don't value it enough. So I've seen better results when we, my team and I and everybody is positive, even in very challenging times with the same budgets, than when we are negative or saying, oh, but it's not going to happen because of COVID or this. And you can always find excuses to be no. You can always find excuses and reasons to fail. But But if you failed and you were positive, not only did you learn more, but then you perhaps will discover something even better to do, which could bring you more profits. That has always happened to me.